Thank you very much. Well, I'm a bit nervous because, well, I thought I liked Toronto, so I would apply for funding for staying here for a week, and then I got an email saying, oh, you get plenty of dollars to stay in Toronto. So I was happy. And I didn't plan to give a talk or anything. I just wanted to have fun, play pool. But about a month ago, I got an email from Antoine saying, send an abstract and title to Vanessa. What abstract? Well, of your talk in Toronto. So I sent an abstract, and now I have to give the talk. So then about a week ago, I looked at the program to find out if it was 20 minutes or 25 minutes. And, well, it was an hour. So I have to tell you everything I know about optimization, because I know about an hour's amount of optimization. Okay, this is the title. And usually a talk starts with an outline. So my outline is here. I will first talk about linear complementarity, then I will talk about unique sync orientations, and then I hope not to have enough time to talk about orientation. But I'll start with a linear program. Well, can you actually read this? So this is my first talk that I'm giving since I've been at Queen's University, and I tried to make slides with Queen's colors. They're not very practical, but anyway, so that's a linear program. That's the dual of the linear program. If you add slack variables and put that into one equation, you get this. And you want the solution to be non-negative. And there's something that's called complementary slackness, which tells you that, well, if one slack variable is zero, then one is non-zero, then the corresponding variable is zero, or something like this. So this is expressed in this complementary condition. Okay. So now you see this is a minimization or a maximization problem, and this is just an existence problem or a solution problem. So if you solve this, you find any solution that corresponds to that satisfies these conditions, then you have an optimal solution to either of those. Okay, in the ideal case. So now, just renaming things. You call this W. You call this M. You call this Z. You call this Q, and you get a problem that looks like this. And this is called the linear complementarity problem. And only one application of it is linear programming. But I started with something that everybody knows, including me. Well, more or less. As a motivation, and but there are more sources to it. Quadratic programming can be written in this form. Two-player games and looking for Nash equilibrium is basically something like that, except that you're not looking for any solution, you're looking for the other solution. Well, there's one solution which is trivial, but also things that I don't know what they are. But people claim that these can also be solved with linear complementarity. What's the geometry of it? Well, the geometry is this. You have vectors E1 and E2. These are just 0, 1, 1, 0. Or in more dimensions, you have many of them. And these are the columns of minus M. In the matrix M. Okay. Now, and you get this this Q. So that was the Q that you were given. And what you want to do is express this Q as a non-negative linear combination of these E1, E2, minus M1, minus M2. So you do it. And that's good. And what is the complementary condition? Well, the complementary condition says that if you're using E1, then you're not allowed to use M1, and if you're using M1, then you're not allowed to use E1. And if you're using E2, then you're not allowed to use M2, and so on. So each time W1 or Z1 has to be 0. So here Z1 is 0. Okay. So the geometry continues. Now, for what values of Q, for what positions of Q can we get a solution? Well, if we are using E1 and E2, then we can solve the problem for Qs in this cone. Okay. Then if we're using E1 and M2, we can get a solution for Q in this cone. Okay, and so on. So eventually, if the matrix M looks like this, these are the columns of minus M, then whenever Q is somewhere here, you can get a solution. You can even get it in several ways. And if it's here, then you cannot get a solution, a complementary solution. What's the computational complexity of this problem? Does anybody know? Everybody knows. Yeah, it's actually NP complete, so it's not so hard, but it's hard. It's hard to decide whether a solution exists. Okay, it's NP complete, so it is in NP, which is not obvious, but you can prove that. Well, it's probably obvious. But you can prove that the solution, the size of the solution is polynomial in the size of the input, so it's in NP, if a solution exists. The hardness proof, just to give you an idea of how that can work, is there is somehow a knapsack problem. So a knapsack problem is to given some numbers, positive integers, A and some B, to decide whether there is a subset of these that sum exactly to B. Okay, so that's a famous NP-hard problem. Now, how do you solve it with LCP? You use, if there are n numbers A, the size of A is n, then you use dimension n plus 2. For each I, you get the condition that wi plus zi is equal to ai. And so the meaning will be, well, one of those, in the solution, one of those is 0. And if wi is 0, then zi has to be ai, and vice versa. So the meaning is, if wi is 0 and zi is equal to ai, then I take the corresponding AI into the subset, and if it's the other way around, then I don't take it. Okay. And here, well, this is non-negative, and this is non-negative, so this expression in the solution has to be 0. So that means that the sum of the Z has to be exactly B. So this is the reduction. Okay, just to an impression. Okay, so it's hard. What do we do? Well, we could try several things. We could try to find algorithms that are not so bad. But what I was doing was examining some special cases. And a special case that has attracted a lot of attention is the case where the matrix M in the input is a P matrix. A P matrix is a square matrix, well, they're all to be square in the input, whose all principal minors are positive. So the determinants, when you select some columns and some rows, the same rows, the principal submatrix has a positive determinant, not non-negative, positive. Okay. Why is that interesting? Or what's the status, actually, of this, is it is unlikely to be NP-hard, in a sense that I will show in a second. It is in the class PPAD that was introduced by Papadimitriou. He always says that it has nothing to do with his name. But but these are some kind of problems that can be solved, that always have a solution, but that can be solved by following a directed path in a digraph, something like that. So for example, one example of a PPAD complete problem is computing the Nash equilibrium of bimatrix games. And Papadimitriou believes that there is no polynomial time algorithm for that, exactly because it is PPAD complete. Well, it's not quite, nobody quite understands what PPAD complete means, but well, for some people it is evidence that there should not be a polynomial time algorithm. But for PLCP, we don't know if it's PPAD complete or not. That would be an interesting problem. And no polynomial time algorithm to find the solution exists. So what do I mean by saying it's unlikely to be NP-hard? Well, if you have a problem, well, okay. So the thing is, a solution always exists with a P matrix, as I will show in a minute as well. But to find it, so now what is NP hard or what is not? So and moreover, it is hard to distinguish P matrices. So that's co NP complete to decide whether a matrix is a P matrix. So you cannot just do the trick and say, well, I can easily check if the matrix is a P matrix, and if it's not, I just refuse. So that's already hard, so you cannot do that. But if you have a problem, even like that, that you get some input to an LCP, so either you find a solution to the LCP, or you find a proof that the matrix is not a P matrix. Okay. So just finding this is hard. Okay, doing this for any matrix is hard. But if you can do one or the other, if that were NP hard, then NP would be equal to co NP, which is not really expected in the complexity community. So if you're given a choice, tell me it's not a P matrix, or give me a solution, then that's unlikely to be hard. But no. Algorithm is known. Well, no polynomial time algorithm. And so as I said, the problem, so that's again a geometric property. If you look at the complementary cones, taking complementary subsets of what complementary bases, as you might like to call them, then what they do is they partition the whole space. So wherever you are, you find a unique way to express this point here as a non-negative linear, as a non-negative complementary linear combination of these vectors. Okay. And there are more nice geometric properties and so on. So, and the complexity status is, as I said, well, probably not NP-hard. We don't know with respect to PPAD. No polynomial time algorithm is known. And now P-naught matrices are matrices where you allow non-negative principal minors. And there, looking for the solution is NP-hard. Positive definite matrices are symmetric P matrices. And there, a polynomial time algorithm is known. So P matrices are somehow in between, and we don't know if they're hard or not. What are some algorithms for LCPs? Well, I'll start with the algorithms that I don't want to talk about, and these are interior point algorithms where you forget that you want W times Z to be zero, but you just minimize it, and then you find something. And in some cases, well, for instance, if for positive definite matrices, you get a convex problem. For P matrices, you get a, well, you don't get quite a polynomial time algorithm. You get close to a polynomial time algorithm, but not quite. Not one that works for all matrices, but you can create arbitrarily large classes of P matrices, and for each of these classes, you get a polynomial time algorithm. What I do want to talk about are pivoting algorithms. And these are algorithms where you take some complementary or almost complementary bases. So that means you do some pre-selection of which of the W's and of the Z's should be zero, and which are allowed to be anything. And then you can solve the problem, ignoring the non-negativity constraints. Okay, then you get some solution where some W's will be negative, some Z's will be negative. So if you happen to get a solution where everything's positive and it's complementary, then you're happy and you're done. If something's negative, then you do pivoting. So you take this corresponding variable out of the bases and you, well, put it in the bases or something like that. And so that's similar to pivoting in linear programming. But of course, you need some kind of a pivot rule. If there are more options what you can pivot, then you need to know how to decide. Do I want to talk about this? I don't. No. Yeah, well, maybe. Okay, so we always assume that so basically, what there is what this wants to say, I don't know why I put it there, because I forgot to take it out, is that, you know, if you recall that picture that we had with the, or something like that, it says that we always assume for some theoretical considerations that the Q is not sitting on the line, or not sitting on those hyperplanes that are the boundaries of the, or not sitting on the boundaries of the complementary cones. So that's all this says. But now, the interesting part. So what is the combinatorics there, which is what I like, is for each I, you have to make a choice. Do I want this Wi to be zero, or do I want the Zi to be zero? Okay. Once I have made a choice for each I, what I do is solve a system of linear equations, and that's easy. So what happens when I've solved the system of linear equations is that, well, if I'm unlucky, I get negative values, and I don't want that. But in this point of view, the continuous part or the geometric part you get rid of the numbers because you just this is purely combinatorial. This is 2 to the n possibilities, and that's what you. That's what I want to look at. So now, simple principle pivoting, at least as I understand this notion, means that you start with a choice for each I, called complementary bases. And then, once you've computed, once you've solved the system of linear equations, you see if it's not feasible, or if it's not feasible, okay, it's always complementary, but if it's not feasible, that means there are some negative values appearing in the solution. You look at some negative variable, you insert it into the basis, so it will become zero in the next solution, and its complementary variable, so you will be removed from the basis. So that means for this particular I, one I, you will change your choice, okay, and you repeat this until you reach the solution. Okay, will you reach the solution? It depends on how you choose for which eye you swap. Well, you might get everything negative, and how do you choose then for which you change your choice? So that's the principal question. Okay, these are just pictures. Okay, this is a childish example of how that might work. So in the beginning I said I want to use E1 and E2, and the coefficients for M1 and M2 will be zero. And I solved, and I got a solution, which is positive here, but negative here. Okay, so here I have no choice. I just have to replace E2 with minus M2, and now I get a solution which is positive in both, so I've solved my problem. And that's not very illustrative because it's too simple, but anyway. I made the pictures, so I wanted to show you. So now, you see, what we do is we walk on 0, 1 vectors. We walk on choices, 2 to the n choices. And 2 to the n choices, that's a hypercube. These are vertices of a hypercube. And now the second part starts. So this is a three-dimensional hypercube. And the unique sink orientation on it is, well, you start with a graph that has, well, vertices as I said, so each vertex in this graph corresponds to a choice of Wi, Zi's, being zero or non-zero. And they're adjacent if you can get one from the other by flipping one choice, so by flipping one bit. So from here, you can get to here if you flip the last bit. Okay. So that's not yet oriented. The orientation comes now. And I want that to put an arrow on each of these edges, oriented, in such a way that every subcube would have a unique sink. So a sink is a vertex from which nothing is outgoing, no outgoing edge. So if I want every subcube to have a unique sink, that means that the whole cube has to have one sink. So that's here. And you see that from every other vertex of the cube, there's at least one outgoing edge. Okay? But not only the whole cube has to have a unique sink, also every proper subcube. So in this case, these are squares and edges. So every square has to have a unique sink. So for example, this square has this sink. What would not be a unique sink orientation is, for example, in this situation, this square would have two sinks. That's not allowed. So this orientation of the cube is not a unique sink orientation. Even though the whole cube has a unique sink, but there is a subcube that has two, and so it's not a unique sink orientation. Okay, and it's also not allowed to have no sink, so this is also not allowed. But in spite of this, well, maybe at the first sight strong condition, there might be directed cycles. So this is an example. Here, that's a unique sink orientation. It satisfies every subcube has a unique sink, but still there is a directed cycle here. Okay. So that also, well, shows that if you wanted to find the sink of this cube by just walking on the edges, and you had a bad rule to select where you want to walk, then you could just walk forever. And actually, this cube does correspond to a linear complementarity problem with P matrices, but we will see that very soon. Because I first have to tell you how they are related. So what's the relation between linear complementarity and unique sink orientations? I think it's probably clear, but it's what I said. Every choice, what are zeros, what are non-zeros, corresponds to a non-zero, zero-one vector, which is a vertex of the hypercube. Then if you solve the equations with this choice, for negative values you put outgoing edges, and for positive values you put incoming edges. And what you will get, if you started with an LCP with a P matrix, is a unique sink orientation. Okay, that's maybe interesting, but how do you prove this? Well, you already have the theorem that there is a unique solution. So that corresponds to the fact that the whole cube will have a unique sink. But then also every subcube corresponds to a PLCP, to an LCP with a P matrix. By, you know, you see that, and then you can prove that every, so that implies that every subcube also has a unique sink. And then, so then in this way you've transformed the problem to a problem of looking for the sink of a unique sink orientation. Now, in general, if you just, you know, you just get a unique sink orientation, give me the sink. Now, you have to say something about how the cube is represented, because if you put the whole cube and its orientation as the input, it would be huge, and then you will just always find the solution in polynomial time because the input is so huge. So here, we represent the input by some kind of an oracle, and you can, and this oracle, if you ask it about the vertex, it will give you the orientation of all edges that come from or to this vertex. And this corresponds in the LCP setting. You can implement this oracle by solving a system of linear equations. So this somehow suggests that it's not such a bad representation. And how do we measure efficiency of the algorithm? Well, by the number of questions to the oracle as a function of the cube's dimension. So we would at best want to have an algorithm that always finds the sink, but asks only polynomially many vertices about their orientation. Mm-hmm. Here I've listed some very general algorithms that try to solve the problem of looking for a sink, A naive algorithm would look at all vertices, do 2 to the n queries, and find the sink. That's very easy. Then there might be some path-following algorithms. So you start somewhere, no matter where, and then you have some rule how to continue, and you just always follow outgoing edges, and if the rule is not too bad, you will eventually find the sink. And then there are some I call them random access algorithms that don't follow any path, but they just ask according to some rules. And these are something that I don't want to talk about today, but I just wanted to mention them because these are the best known general algorithms with the best bounds so far. So these are just some best known bounds. This is expected number of queries by some randomized algorithm. What is rather annoying about this is that the best known lower bound, saying that you have to ask at least this many, is n squared, or less than n squared, really. So the best we can do is something like 1.4 to the n, and the best lower bound is n squared. It's it's quite a lot of work to do. Yeah. Right. So for P matrices, as I said, we don't know any polynomial time algorithm. What do we know? We can look at some subclass of P matrices. So matrices that are called K matrices or some Minkowski matrices and things like this. So these are, this is a matrix which is a P matrix, but also we want all off-diagonal elements to be non-positive. And for these matrices, we know how to solve the corresponding LCP fast. In fact, that had been known, that has been known for a long time, so it had been known before we tried to do it. So what was new, what we discovered was, well, there was a polynomial time algorithm known. Well, we refined this a bit by saying that whatever you do, if you just follow outgoing arrows, you will never take more than 2n plus 1 steps or something like this. So wherever you start, if you're drunk, you don't really care, you just ask whatever you want. But you always only walk in the correct direction, then you will find the solution very fast. How do the unique sync orientations help to prove such a thing? Well, if you have an orientation that comes from an LCP with a K matrix, then for every two outgoing edges in a square like this, you know that these two will be parallel with them. So that's a very strong property of a unique sync orientation. And if you have this property, then you just look at it and contemplate for a couple of minutes, and then you see that you cannot make too many mistakes. So you will really, in 2n, after traversing 2n edges, in the worst case, you'll get to the sink. So another question that we asked was, is this lemma characteristic for K USOs, for unique sync orientations coming from LCPs with a K matrix? And it's not, because there are very many of them. But the orientations that can ever come from an LCP with a P matrix, there are only few of them. So it cannot be a characterization. And the K matrix is even a special case, so there are even fewer of them. The idea of the proof of the upper bound here is, well, what you see, that the orientation is determined by the signs of some quantities, okay? And you can prove, or it's not very difficult to see, that the quantities whose signs you want to look at have the same, well, they're not exactly polynomials because you have to divide by something, but the signs are the same as the signs of some polynomials in variables that are entries of the matrix and entries of this vector. So it's some kind of an arrangement. You can look at it as some arrangement of algebraic surfaces, and the surfaces have degree at most n by something, and then you're interested in knowing how many cells there are if you put these surfaces into the space. And in every cell, well, that might correspond to some USO, that might not correspond. But when you have a USO coming from a P matrix, then the orientation will certainly sit in one of those cells. And then you use some algebraic geometry theorem an old one, which says that the number of cells is at most this, and then eventually this gives you this bound. It's just an idea. More on counting. The recognition of K matrices. I think it's easy. That's a good question. I'm not sure at this moment, but I think that's easy. I don't know. Okay, so there are some numbers. Okay. What's interesting is this lower bound. So the number of unique sync orientations coming from, the number of all unique sync orientations is quite well understood, well up to some kind of a constant factor in this exponent. So of course it's up to exponential difference, but, or exponential factor. So I don't know if this is a satisfactory bound, but anyway. And quite few of them come from LCPs. So only, you see that this is doubly exponential, whereas this is just exponential. So maybe if you're interested in linear complementarity, then looking for a general algorithm that solves all unique sync orientations is a waste of time, because, well, you don't know, but there are so many of them, and you have to take care of all these, whereas what you're interested in are only very few. So who knows? What are whole Klee unique sync orientations? Well, what we call whole Klee is that if you look at a square, then there will always be two vertex disjoint directed paths from the source to the sink. If you look at a subcube of dimension 3, there will be three, and so on. This is not true in every unique sync orientation, but it is true in every unique sync orientation coming from a PLCP. So the question that we asked and we cannot answer is this combinatorial condition sufficient to find the polynomial time algorithm? Well, we don't know. In fact, there are still very, very many of them. There are still doubly exponentially many of them, but discounting this might give some kind of an intuition where an algorithm, a polynomial time algorithm, would be possible and where not, but it doesn't really give you any more hints than just the numbers. Okay, just to impress you, this is how you... Does it work at all? This is how we did, how we came up with the lower bound for K USOs. Well, then you have to do some tricks. So this will be the matrix, this will be the Q, and then you have to find these betas in the right way. And if you found them, then you found the K matrix. And if you do that in a clever way, then you have so many choices. And each of them results in a different orientation. So I'm not expecting anyone to understand this, but it seems that I'm just... Okay, the next thing is Well, I showed already something about randomized algorithms. The motivation to study randomized algorithms, well, is as usual. If you have a deterministic algorithm, or a pivot rule in this case, then most often somebody will be able to come and say, well, on this cube, it's slow. And then you say, okay, so I have a different rule. And then they will come again and say, oh, no, but this one is slow on this cube. And so then you will tell them, so with probability 1/2 I will do the first algorithm, and with probability 1/2 I will do the second algorithm, and now it's not, well, done. Okay, so something like that. So we found a bad example for every deterministic rule. Okay.
How about the history
based? That's very... Yeah. I don't know. Well, they're too difficult for me to analyze. So I didn't dare. So I don't know. Yeah. But you're right. Well, some suggestions about randomized pivot rules. This one just always chooses randomly out of the outgoing edges. And this one, it's not really history based, but it's somewhat similar. So in what Noether's least index rule does is it always chooses the outgoing edge with the least index. Okay. This randomized version fixes a permutation of the indices in the beginning and then works with this permutation of indices. Okay, so for randomized Murthy, there is the Clemin decube, for the least index rule, there is the Clemin decube, which is also a PUSO. If you look at it as an abstract cube. So if you take this rule as deterministic without choosing a permutation in the beginning, with just some fixed permutation, that's slow. That can take 2 to the n steps or something like that. But for the random one, choose a random permutation in the beginning, again, not much known. So I don't know any bad example where this would be more than quadratic. But I know no proof that this is always the case. That's also very difficult to analyze because, you know, the randomness is hidden just in the beginning. But then, yeah. Whereas this is much simpler to analyze. And for example, if you take LCPs with this matrix, then Walter Morris showed that the random edge takes this many iterations in expectation as a lower bound for the expected runtime. Well, if you look at this number, this is much more than 2 to the n. So this is much slower than looking at every vertex. Okay. So this just basically kills this algorithm. This is no good. Don't use it. But we looked at this bad example, and if you take the random permutation in the beginning and then follow the least index rule, and starting anywhere, this will take a quadratic number of steps. So do I still have time? Yes, please do. Oh, well, that was, no, that was, no, but that was a result of the form that saying that for any algorithm whatsoever, a deterministic one, there are orientations on which the algorithm takes at least n squared steps. Okay. So that's something that no algorithm can beat. But for every specific algorithm that you give me, you will probably find something worth, except for this one, I don't know. Well, one day you will.
On random edge, the new results of Oliver Friedman and so forth, the linear program using random edge rules, so that must translate into also lower bounds.
Yes, probably, yeah. Yeah. But what I was talking about was... Okay, well, in fact, so for this algorithm, I don't know any bad examples. Well, I do know bad examples. There are bad examples in the USO, general USO setting, that are super polynomial, sub-exponential, something like e to the square root of n. But, okay, they're due to Matoshek. And first of all, they're not very explicit because he just gives, you know, look at this class of orientations and the expectation over a random orientation chosen from these is bad. So there has to be one of them that is bad, that is slow. Okay, but he doesn't tell you which one it is. But if you, out of these, if you take only those that satisfy the Holt-Klee condition, so the condition that is satisfied by all P USOs, so coming from P LCPs, it gets down to quadratic as well. So.
I mean, the example of Matoshek, if I understand, is not even realized in a matrix, but it's really like an...
Exactly. So if out of those, if you take those orientations that could possibly realize a matrix, it gets down to n squared. Yeah. Do I still have time?
Do you want to stop?
No, I have to do the matrix now. Well, I can just go through the matrix. So this is that, and okay. This is the complementarity problem. This is the same problem with different names. Okay. Now, what I do in complementarity is there are some numbers. What I do in matrix is I forget the numbers, so I only look at the signs. Okay. And so I look at not really solutions to this matrix equation, but to sign patterns of all the solutions. So I look at what solves this equation, and I look at the sign patterns taken coordinate-wise. And the collection of these sign vectors is the set of vectors of an oriented matroid. What is an oriented matroid? Well, there are some elements. Then there are some vectors, and the vectors are sine vectors that satisfy some axioms. These are the axioms, and yeah, and some other things. An important thing is a basis, which is a set of elements that no vector is sitting on. So. Oh, that's an independent set, and the maximal one is a basis. So it's like in matrix. You probably know matrix. You probably even know more about oriented matrix than I do. Well, in any case. Okay, so a basis is something that contains no vector, okay, and is maximal with this property. To do complementarity problems, we have to introduce some complementarity to oriented matrix, because complementarity is not present in oriented matrix as such. So what we do is we put some complementarity on the set of elements, and then these are some, this is something that's called a one element extension in oriented matrix, or in matrix theory. So these are the vectors, they are sine vectors, they come in complementary pairs, and there's one which has no mate, and that's the one that corresponds to the Q. Okay, so if you want to solve the oriented matroid complementarity problem, that means finding a vector in the set of vectors of the matroid that, well, has no minus, so that's the non-negativity, is complementary, that means out of these two, at least one is zero, and this last thing is positive. I still have to go on. Huh. What does this say? this is a characterization of matroids that come from not really. So, okay. If M is a P matrix, then the matroid that you get satisfies this property. Okay. The converse is almost true. So if a matroid satisfies this property and it is realizable in the sense that it is indeed a sign pattern of such a thing, then this matrix here is a P matrix. So, but it need not. So not every matroid is realizable in this sense. So. We don't know about those. Okay. And this is a similar lemma, that's our lemma, for K. Right? So this is a K matrix. And the matroid coming from a K matrix here satisfies, well, a K matrix is a P matrix, so it satisfies this. And then it satisfies some other condition. So this condition is illustrated here in some way, which I can't. Right. I think this is a counterexample to, well, not a counterexample. So this is an example of a vector that can never appear in a matrix satisfying this, because XZ is non-negative, so that's the lower row. That's non-negative. So if this is non-negative in this vector, then a plus up here would have to apply a plus, imply a plus here, which here it doesn't. So this can never appear. I think, is it correct, Lorenz? Yeah, it's Lorenz who prepared this. He's back there. Mm-hmm. He knows much more about matrix than I. Okay, now about the K matrices, there is an old theorem from 1962 that was published in the Czechoslovak Mathematical Journal by Fiedler and Ptak. And the theorem looks like this. Okay, so for a Z matrix, so that's a matrix that has off-diagonal elements non-positive, there are 13 equivalent conditions. One of them is number 8, so that's how I defined a P matrix. So for such a matrix, being a P matrix is equivalent to plenty of things. We looked at some of those things and translated them into the language of oriented matrices. So those are the E's. And these are the conditions for the dual matroid. So if you don't know what the dual matroid is, you will not understand. If you know what the dual matroid is, you will not understand, because there's not enough time. What does this say? I don't know. Okay, so there is a theorem of Todd. So what, how do you do the pivoting? Oh, this explains how you do the pivoting. So how do you do the algorithm on the matroid? Well, you start with some, you start actually with some bases or something like this. So you ask the matroid, if I want a plus here, and a non-zero here, and a non-zero here, and a zero here, and a zero here, the matroid is able to tell you what signs you have to put here. Okay? And so it tells you minus, minus. So you haven't found the solution because you're looking for a solution where there are no minuses. Right? So you can change your selection, for instance, on this sign, and you will ask the matroid, give me something that's zero here, and zero here, and plus there. Okay? And we'll give you this. And still you haven't found your solution. So you ask it, you change your choice here, so you ask it, and then eventually you will get it, okay? So this is how principal pivoting algorithms work on matroids. That's a very, very rough sketch. Oh, I'm running out of time. Okay, so if it's a P matroid, then when you've chosen a minus, then after you've changed your choice here, what you will get here will not be a minus. Okay, that's the theorem. You don't know what will happen in the rest, but certainly there won't be a minus here. For K matroids, what will happen is... Okay, so, so suppose this is a plus here. Okay. Now, you're not happy because this is not a solution, so we will ask the matroid to swap this, to flip this part. Now, if this is a K matroid, so coming from a K matrix, then this plus here will not change into a minus. So you remember you had these question marks here in the beginning. So you don't know what will happen there on a P matroid, but you know on a K matroid that a plus will stay a plus. But that's only true in the lower part. In the upper part, if you have a plus, it might still change into a minus. And then you have to flip it again, but then it will be a plus down here, and then it will stay forever. So if you can prove this lemma, that a plus down here always stays a plus and never changes into minus while pivoting, then what you've proved is at most two steps. So if you see this, you flip on this coordinate, you get a plus, it might change into a minus somewhere on the way, and you flip it again, then it's a plus and it will stay plus forever. So you never do more than two steps here, so that's a proof of the two n bound for an algorithm for K LCPs. Nobody understands this proof. Not even I do. That's almost my last slide. This is all I've been saying in an hour put on one slide. What's interesting is this, that it's linear algebra, it's some geometry, it's discrete geometry, it's algebraic geometry, that is the, you know, the bound on the counting. It's also some kind of an order theory, which was a lower bound on some, which I didn't show, a lower bound on the number of some USOs satisfying some condition. And some open problems. I've probably mentioned all of them. What is the complexity of PLCP? Is there a polynomial algorithm? Is it PPAD complete? For general USOs, is there a sub-exponential algorithm? Well, I showed the bound was a randomized sub-exponential for acyclic USOs, but there might be cycles. Well, this Holt precondition, is it a strong enough combinatorial condition for a polynomial time algorithm? And maybe find a better lower bound, so that was the n squared for any algorithm. That seems like too little. In the end, if you can do LCP with something a bit larger than P matrices, then you could do linear programming and polynomial time as well. So. So, right, so thank you.